Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
My name is Angelo Carasone, better known as Stop Back on Twitter, and primarily I spend my time I'm trying to debunk right-wing lies that permeate our media, and there's one of the places that we do it is on Bob Carson's show.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013. And you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour. And I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hi, this is David Levitt, your host from SYM Radio. SYM Radio is helping raise awareness to missing persons, parental stranger abductions, and human trafficking through our partners. We also raise awareness that people with disabilities can do whatever they set their mind to through the love of God and Christ. And we're proud to be an affiliate with Carson's Corner. And you're listening to Carson's Corner with Jay Ray and Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio and also at SYMradio.com/live.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it, too. I encourage you to listen.
You're listening to 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio.
Underground Progressive Radio, 5:30 a.m. and blogtalkradio.com. This is Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson. Very pleased to have you with us here today. 347-326-9749 if you want to call in and be a part of the program. We also have the chat room open for anybody out there. We have two very, very interesting guests here today. Our first guest who's on the line right now is the chairman of the Revolutionary Unity Michigan, Wade Jackson. Very proud to have him on the show. I've been friends with him on Facebook for a while now, and really am quite intrigued by his posts. Seems to be a very intelligent young man, and I wanted to find out more about what he's got going on and some of his thoughts and how it relates to the Zeitgeist movement, which we've really been focusing on. I think, after seeing these films by Peter Joseph, it really has changed my perspective on thinking. And there are a lot of people out there, too, as well, that have really been affected by these films and the work of Peter Joseph. And how does this tie into Marxism, and how do we go forward and whatnot? And then in our second hour, we're going to be talking to Jeff Howard, who's no stranger to this program. We've had Jeff Howard on this program for a few years now. He is one of the most passionate progressive activists out there. He's really almost a full-time activist He's going to talk to us about some of the gun legislation that he helped get through in Connecticut. His activism certainly helped. And other states are following suit now, and looks like the federal government is talking about universal background checks. Maybe we'll delve into that a little later on. But without further ado, let's go to our first guest today. Wade Jackson joins us now on the line. Wade, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How you doing?
Good. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Like I said, I've really been intrigued by some of your posts and some of your perspectives on Facebook. So, you know, I wanted to extend an invitation for you to come on the program. I wanted just to start off, if you can, by explaining what this group is, the Revolutionary Unity Michigan is.
Revolutionary Unity Michigan is a affiliate of the group Revolutionary Unity, which started out as a, at least from my knowledge, as a faction of the CPUSA, which embraced a much more revolutionary tendency than the reformist members of the CPUSA, and eventually it went from being a faction to being its own independent organization. So that's what I'm involved in.
Yeah, I would imagine that it's to get involved with a group like this, or to there must be. I mean, you're feeling probably a lot like I'm feeling, and like many other people out there, that there is just a genuine problem with the system. It's really broken. I think everybody understands that. I mean, even Tea Party people really understand that, and it's not working. So we have to start looking outside of the traditional approaches in terms of elections and supporting both political parties and supporting an economic system that really is failing us all.
Right. I would say that the system was pretty much broken to begin with, because you have a system that's structured on competition and profit incentive, and when you have a system like that, it does not really promote innovation, or it doesn't go beyond the bounds of anything that is outside of the drive for capital accumulation. And that's pretty much been the big problem since its very inception. The system of capitalism originated in this, actually began in the 16th century with the burgesses, the feudal nobility that existed at this time, and a lot of the revolutions that have existed throughout history are bourgeois revolutions. The American Revolution was a capitalist revolution. It severed ties with the monarchy. The same thing can be said with the French Revolution, which the French Revolution is sort of the beginnings of French socialism. But anyway, the system has evolved over time. It began as a mercantile capitalism, where you had small special trades groups that shoe cobblers and stuff like that, and journeymen, that it started out like that, and then it moved to more industrial methods during the Industrial Revolution, and that's when the beginning you had the big drive of finance capital in the system as a form of commodity. And from there you had the rise of imperialism, which you had colonialist encroachments by Britain and France and even the United States in developing countries like India, like countries in Africa, in which the populations of those countries were systematically reaped of their pillaged of their resources and pretty much put into slavery, wage slavery, but slavery nonetheless. And the only groups in those societies that benefited were the people who were supportive of these colonialist encroachments, the dictators, the monarchies, you know, the absolutist elite. And from there, you have the beginnings of what we now see as globalization, the reign and domination of global capital. And the system is falling apart because, as Marx said, capital cannot abide by a limit. It either tries to circumvent or transcend that set limit. And so it really is about the accumulation of infinite amounts of capital on a finite planet,
mm-hmm.
because the resources on this planet cannot be reaped without any kind of regeneration. And the Zeitgeist movies depict that very clearly. And how the Zeitgeist movies relate to Marx is that Marx and Engels, during their time, pretty much saw the route that capitalism was going, and their successors throughout history, like Lenin, saw the beginnings of imperialism and the beginnings of the rise of finance capital, of the Rothschilds and, you know, the robber barons. And so what the Zeitgeist movies depict is pretty much nothing that has not been elaborated on by Marxist theorists throughout history.
Absolutely. And you know, it's I it, do they I mean what's the way to go forward from here? Because, you know, I think that we're really headed for an inevitable collapse. There's just no question about that. And really, you know, the collapse is inherent in the system.
Right.
And it's designed to happen, and it is going to happen. And, you know, we sort of saw this collapse in 2008 with the stock market. But unfortunately, the people really didn't gather for true reform, and nothing happens. So what is sort of the way forward here? What would, and I want to go further into some of Marx's responses, if you will, to
right.
You know, certain notions of capitalism. But what is really the way forward here? What ultimately is going to happen?
Well, you have. I like to break it up into two camps. You have the conformists and reformists. The conformists are pretty much the people who stay on the path. They don't really diverge from the norms, political norms at least. Then you have reformists who want to reform the system and change it and humanize it. And the reason why, and then you also have the advocates of revolutionary tendency, and I'm sort of the revolutionary tendency, because to me, reform is not possible. Because as long as you have the capitalists controlling the state, which, you know, you have the Koch brothers, you have the Rothschilds, you have the Rockefellers, you have the Warburgs. I mean, you have tons of you know, parties, families that have existed since time immemorial, since the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, that have pretty much controlled the ins and outs of government, and the revolving door between politicians and the corporate elite is very apparent to anyone. So as long as the capitalists control the state, there will be no reform. There will be no social reform. There will be no workers' rights. You will only have privileges that the capitalists could take away at any time. And you see this with the encroachment of right-to-work legislation, with the dwindling of labor rights, because they weren't rights to begin with. They were privileges that the capitalists allowed them to have, because if you can get the working class complacent, they will not attack the ruling class. They will not see them as the enemy. And the thing is that, like, for example, the Warren Buffett coming out in favor of raising taxes on the rich, that was a deterrent, because he knows that if you make the people complacent, they are not going to rise up. And so I see revolution as being the only alternative. That is, the complete overthrow of all social institutions and conditions that pretty much exist within the capitalist system. And that also includes not only exploitation, but also domination in every aspect of life. And those things, those aspects of it, are more or less what are gradually changed in society after the revolution.
So now, once, I mean, are you talking about a political revolution or a violent revolution?
Not necessarily. It is possible to have a peaceful revolution. It is possible. In fact, the October Revolution of 1917 is a perfect example of this. There was hardly, when the insurrection happened, there was hardly any amount of blood spilled. It was actually the most bloodless revolution in the history of revolutions. It wasn't until the Russian Civil War that things began to escalate.
Yeah, well, I mean, and then from there, dismantling institutions, what type of, I mean, would you advocate communism at that point, where
No, I wouldn't advocate communism, because communism is not possible in one country. It isn't possible. You have to have socialism, has to be worldwide for communism to even be developed. And the reason is that, let me define what communism is. Communism is not an authoritarian regime. Communism is a stateless and classless society in which there is no market mechanisms of exchange. There is no currency. It's basically no different than the concept of the resource-based economy, and it's governed by the principles of each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs.
And so, if not communism, what type of I mean, economic system, you know, possibly can we have here in the United States? I mean, are you basically saying that if we'd have to have a, I guess as Marx said, we'd have to have a worldwide revolution in which these principles are accepted everywhere?
Right. The world revolution would probably wouldn't happen all at once. You would have possibly revolutions in one country or maybe even several countries, depending on the conditions, depending on the combination of factors. Like, for example, the Russian Revolution was successful, but after that you had a series of other revolutions throughout different countries in response to the October Revolution that pretty much failed. You had the Spartacus League in Germany, for example, that was headed by Rosa Luxemburg, that failed, and both her and her colleague, I can't pronounce his name, I'm not going to even try. both of them ended up being killed by the Social Democrats. But that's an example, and that's why you had the isolation of Russia in the beginning. But the kind of revolution that we could see is whether it's violent or peaceful, is really entirely up to the capitalist class itself. Because you look at Occupy Wall Street this was peaceful demonstrations.
Right.
The police maced the protesters. They beat up the protesters. There are dozens of cases of police brutality and provocation by NYPD during the height of the Occupy protests. So if the police are going to brutalize peaceful demonstrators who are exercising their constitutional rights, who's to say they wouldn't go as far as pulling a Bloody Sunday and shoot them?
Right.
And there are plenty of examples of police officers shooting at demonstrators throughout America's history, especially during the 1960s. You had Kent State, another example of police as far as violent escalation. And,
yeah. Some of the stuff regarding the Black Panthers with Fred Hampton, who was assassinated in 1969 with a government program designed to take out black leaders that was carried out by police departments, and you're absolutely right, and these actions are representing the will of the ruling elite. And I talk about this on this program, is the political will in this country. You look at the Supreme Court in America, how the Supreme Court probably later on this summer is going to strike down a key provision in the Civil Rights Act and Article 5 of the Civil Rights Act, which is going to lead to all these type of laws that you alluded to earlier, these voter ID racist laws that previously had to be cleared by the federal government. That's going to be eliminated because there's political will in this country to limit people from voting, and that's not democracy. I mean, all you got to do is look at Republican-controlled houses, and you'll see all types of measures to keep certain people from voting, and that's a reflection on the political will in this country. And Social Security is another example. Our President Obama, who's a so-called liberal president, according to the corporate media, obviously he's no such thing, proposes cuts in Social Security, which would drastically alter people's lives and make it easier to privatize these programs. These are all measures of the political will in this country. And I do think that we're moving towards a revolution. Unfortunately, we're also moving, and I want to get your opinion on this, towards fascism, I believe.
Right, and I would agree. I already think that the beginnings of fascism in America are already here.
Yeah.
I think that it is we're not only leading to fascism, we're leading to a fascist theocracy. And musician Frank Zappa, during an interview, actually pointed this out, and the panelists, the reactionary panelists on there, were condemning him, saying, "Oh, you're insane. You don't know what you're talking about. This country is, has a very progressive mindset." And you look at the country today, and that's exactly the direction we're headed in.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, between the Patriot Act and the NDAA, the American people's rights are gradually being stripped of them, to the point where we aren't going to have any. And that just proves another point that that you don't have, as long as there is a class that can take away your rights, as long as there is a state that can take away your rights, you're not free. You don't have rights. You have privileges. And, I mean, Vladimir Lenin pointed this out. He said, as long as the state exists, there can be no talk of freedom. But when the state ceases to exist, that's when freedom exists. You know, the American concept of freedom is bourgeois freedom. It is the freedom to exploit the freedom of the rich. I mean, that's like, it's the same with democracy in the United States. We don't have democracy.
Right.
We have democracy of the rich, because the rich are the ones who pull the strings, who have a voice that is not just backed up by words, but backed up by money.
Was it Marx that said that we have an illusion of democracy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's absolutely right. And I mean I think we have to have some sort of framework. We have to have some sort of structure. In any country, we have to have some sort of rule and some sort of regulation. Just my opinion. You know, we need some sort of, or you know, social control, because I don't trust any of the powerful elite.
Right.
If there was nothing, no recourse for us. I mean, look, granted, if you try to sue a corporation, you can't. Ralph Nader pointed this out. You can't even sue a corporation anymore. It's almost impossible because there's so many tiers to these different corporations. It's very difficult. These corporations, they practically own the judges and whatnot, and so, you know, I mean, and look at Wall Street now, where our own attorney general says, oh, they're too big to jail and whatnot. And that's certainly the case, and it's a joke. The regulatory capture and revolving doors you alluded to earlier. I want to sort of ask you a question here, because, you know, obviously you're very well versed in Marx and the communism and some of the previous leaders and so on and so forth. I want to ask you, because I read some of Marx's works, and I agree with his assessment on capitalism. I think it's obviously right on. I think most scholars would agree that Marx had a lot of his criticism towards capitalism has unfortunately come to fruition here. But one thing that I want to talk about, Wade, and because I talk about this on the show, is the profit motive, how inherently evil it is to have a profit motive. And Peter Joseph in the Zeitgeist movies really hits on this, how the for-profit system is based on inefficiency. It's not based on efficiency. It leads to financial ruin all across the globe. Take a look at our healthcare industry, for example. It's a measure of sick and dying, and yet we continue to spend more and more money on healthcare. And it's absolutely evil. It really is. But isn't there some necessity as far as a profit? I mean, like a business owner, somebody making money, don't they have to make some sort of profit to continue the operation? Like, isn't at some point making money or making a profit necessary in an economy? What would Marx say about that?
Well, the reference I'm going to use isn't necessarily Marx, but there is a video on Fora TV on YouTube that talked about what motivates us, and there was a study done at MIT in which a group of leading economists got a group of students together, and they had this project of incentivized reward. And you know, if you did poor, you'd get, you know, you wouldn't get anything. If you did, you know, okay, you got a little. If you did, you know, average, you got more. But if you did really good, you'd get this grand prize. Okay. And so they did the program. They checked the results. When it came to menial labor, the specs were right on it. You know, profit incentives. You know, everyone did really good. But when it came to creativity and critical thinking, the program project, just the results were not the same. It's just complete, total reversal. And they thought, well, these are MIT students. You know, they're not, you know, as motivated as, you know, people that, you know, want to be motivated. Okay, so they took it to, I believe it was Mumbai, India. And they ran the same project there, and they got the same results. When menial labor, profit incentive, total, you know, alignment. Creativity, critical thinking, same failure, absolute reversal. And what became apparent in this is that people are not just driven by profit. They are also driven by purpose. And there are lots of cases in which people are more purpose-driven than they are profit-driven. In fact, there is a good example of this. A company, I believe, based out of Australia, Atlantis or something like of that name, they go to every Friday, they go to all of their software developers and say, you can work on anything you want as long as you bring it back to us at the end of the day. And a lot of what develops from this is they come up with new softwares. They come up with they undo glitches. They basically, the amount of creativity and development is staggering. It's just mind blowing to see what they come up with at the end of the day, according to this video. And what I've come to really believe is that the profit incentive is not inherent in human genetics. There is no greed gene. There is nothing that makes people desire for profit. The profit incentive, as it exists because of capital, because of the existence of capital. The purpose incentive is completely natural because it's not based on any exterior benefit other than one's own, you know, status, you know, and esteem. And the thing is that other creatures in the animal kingdom are perfectly adapt to this. They do have profit incentive. So I think that purpose incentive is a natural aspect of the human personality, of human nature, whereas profit incentive is completely artificial and created by the rule of capital.
Oh yeah, and you could, I mean, you could even see this too. Like, I mean, and it, like altruism and human behavior, and you know, the idea of the collectivism, and how we essentially are wired from a very young age to help people and to not necessarily worry about, you know, what am I going to get for this? I mean, you can really see this in children. I mean, children are some of the most, I mean, perfect examples of, I want to say, socialism, because a child will automatically look to help, you know, something, automatically look to do the right thing. They're very, very innocent, and you know, somehow or another, when they grow up, some children who may become business owners and they may become Wall Street executives or whatever, somehow get the idea of you know, making profit as their only motivation, and the young altruism, you know, how they were as a child, sort of deteriorates. So I think it's certainly, you know, learned within our system. It's learned behavior, this idea of competition and being the best. And one ideology that really goes into this is objectivism. I think that this ideology, really espoused by Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman and others, is really at the root of, although, I mean, capitalism was created, as you mentioned, you know, well before it, but this idea of almost social Darwinism has really taken control, it really accelerated our economic policies, because I would argue, Wade, that really in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, capitalism was much less burdensome to the American people than it is today. And this is one of the things that allows me to say, because I don't believe in, I wouldn't say I'm a communist. Again, I agree
right.
with a lot of what Marx said, but I don't think communism as a system would necessarily do us solve any of the problems that we exist today. It may make it better in certain sectors. I mean, I don't know, because really communism hasn't been, I mean, it's been tried, but not to the extent that it hasn't been applied the way it should have been in, you know, China,
right.
in Russia. It's
right.
So really Marx's ideas really have never been tested. But,
well,
go ahead.
Okay, well, to get into the historical aspects of why what happened with the Soviet Union and China and the other examples of socialist countries is that it began with after the death of Vladimir Lenin in 1924. You had the establishment of a dictatorial bureaucracy by Joseph Stalin, and Leon Trotsky and the other supporters of world revolution and socialist democracy were either killed or exiled. According, you know, I mean, everyone knows about the Stalinist purges during the 1930s, in which, you know, the old guard of the Bolshevik Party was pretty much wiped out, and the Stalinist regimes of Eastern Europe and Asia were a right deviation. They were not genuine Marxist examples of socialism. So, but the thing is that the crimes of these countries really are, for me, if they don't fit the principles, they're not really authentic.
Right.
So for me, you know, China and Russia and, you know, and the other Soviet satellite states, really, they might have had aspects of it, but they didn't have everything. They didn't have the overall picture of it, of as far as the principles of true democracy. They were very authoritarian, very centralized, and it didn't follow the program that Marx and Lenin had established.
Right.
So,
exactly. So therefore, you know, when people rail, oh, look what happened in Russia, and look what happened in China, they're not pointing to what Marx was really espousing, and they use this. This is unfortunately used as bludgeons in this country as instruments of force to gain submission to capitalism, and we hear this all
right.
the time. Is that like even the word socialism, the word socialist is a dirty word in our country. Even though you know what, most people, and you're a young guy, you're younger than I am. Most younger people now, people your age and maybe a little bit younger than I am, are starting to accept the idea of socialism. It's not becoming necessarily a dirty word with younger Americans, because I remember seeing a poll a few years ago where if you polled a certain amount of Americans certain age, it's 50-50 whether or not they support capitalism or whether or not they support socialism. And the Marxist and being called the names and being called this and that, unfortunately, class warfare, it's used to suppress the people and essentially suppress other ideas into the marketplace of ideas. And that's what the beneficiaries of capitalism always do. Those that control the media, they stop debate. They stop all sorts of activity that essentially threatens their power and their upward mobility. And it's really unfortunate. But you know what? I think we're at the point now where we are to a certain extent a socialist country. We're moving towards fascism. I would argue we're more of a fascist country, but we do have certain areas of socialism in our country. We have Social Security,
right.
We have Medicare, and we have Veterans Administration. And these programs, these areas of socialism, are very, very well received by the American people.
Right, right. And the kind of economy that the United States has is defined as a mixed economy. It's a mixture of private and public. Private, part capitalist, part socialist. But I wouldn't say that we have completely become a socialist country.
No.
One of the major aspects of socialism is, and you're going it's most people are going to probably be thrown off by this, but it's a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, as mentioned by Abraham Lincoln. And even Abraham Lincoln said that labor is independent and superior to capital, because capital is the result of labor.
Right.
Therefore labor is superior, and therefore, I guess you could say the working class is therefore superior to the capitalist, because the working class is the people whose labor it goes into making the services that the capitalists in turn sell for a profit.
Yep.
It's not the capitalists who are the ones producing the commodities. It's the working class who are producing the commodities.
They just own the means of production.
Right, exactly. And one thing that Marx pointed out is the history of all existing societies has been the history of class struggle. And if you look at the past history of humanity, you have these different eras in history in which you had slave societies, you had feudalism and so forth, and you had hierarchy, you had structure, and you had people who benefited from the system, and you had people who were impoverished by the system. You had, in feudal times, you had the serfs, and then you had the journeymen and the guildsmen and everything that pretty much kept the serfs in place. So that way the people, the lords, knights, and kings could all benefit from the system. And the same thing exists within capitalism. You have the bourgeoisie, which is the capitalist class, the 1%, as you call it, or the 60%, whatever you want to call it. And then you have the petty bourgeoisie, which is the small business proprietor. Now, this is a Marxist perspective. This isn't, monetary perspective. And then you have the proletariat, which is, the working class, and then you have the lumpen proletariat, which is basically the poor and the criminal, as he coined it. And these classes all have different interests. They have all, and the petty bourgeoisie is put there and is tempted with the golden carrot, saying you could be just like us people on the hill. And the small business owners see that, they like it, they receive it, and it's called the American dream. That's the myth that is propagated by the capitalist class, that anyone who wants to start a business can be just as profitable as us. Well, that's not true. And there are many historical examples in this country of people who have tried to get on the hill, but the capitalists have actually axed them from any competition.
Well, this goes to a great book I can recommend to you. It's called The Self-Made Myth. It's by Stephen Hill. It talks about, now you've got one out of every three Americans believing that they're going to be a millionaire, even though that there's no upwards mobility in this country. Is that basically the number one indication of where you're an adult is where you were, the socioeconomic class you're born into, so that's a great book of people. Just, it's not only small business owners that that are lured with this carrot. It's everyday average American workers, and that's unfortunate.
Right, and that kind of goes into the trade unionist mentality. And Marxists have Marx and a lot of his successors talk about the mentality that trade unionists have. That they don't exactly have a very developed class consciousness. Instead, they don't see themselves as members of the working class. They pretty much see themselves as members of, as embarrassed millionaires, basically.
Yep.
And they defend the capitalist system, even though they are exploited by it, even though they don't own any means of production.
Yep.
And they are still servants of the capitalists. They are still lulled by this. As people within my framework refer to it as bourgeois morality.
Yep.
You can see hints of it in the way people talk.
Yep.
And it's very easy to detect even within liberal groups. It's very easy to detect because the and this is where a lot of conservatives kind of irk me a bit, because they always insinuate that liberals and communists are pretty much the same thing, is that liberals are not necessarily anti-capitalist. They want regulation of the marketplace so as to keep it fair and honest and try to humanize the system when the system is not humane to begin with.
Right.
And these regulations are really a band-aid. They don't actually solve any of the contradictions, but instead actually create new ones that they have to then create more legislation to curb that new contradiction. So it's an endless cycle of regulation of a system that is not, it's like trying to cage a wild beast.
Right.
When you're using material and you only have materials that can't hold them.
What about democratic socialism? What we see in countries like Sweden and Norway, where you have a more equal society there. There is private ownership in these societies, but there's also a very, very strong social safety net, an essential truce between capital and labor, and healthcare for all. What do you think about some of the democratic socialist countries out there?
I would say that is a good start. Even Venezuela is similar. And there were capitalists in Soviet Union and China. Because what happened is that you had an independent private sector, which is no different than here in the United States. You have a private sector and then you have a public sector. And so you really can't, at this point, I don't see the need to penalize small business owners because I don't see small business personally as a threat to the working class. As far as inhibiting their ability to have rights, I see more of the problem being the corporations and the financial institutions, which I believe need to be nationalized and put under public control, because we're talking nationalization of oil, we're talking nationalization of, you know, the different sources of energy. We're talking nationalization of healthcare. And I'm not saying, you know, because Obamacare is not socialized.
Not
healthcare.
No, it's not
by a long shot. If you look at it in principle, it's more of a mandatory bailout for the health insurance companies, and it still relies heavily on the private sector providing the health insurance and providing the services. And so that's not socialized health care at all.
No.
So basically that's the way I see. I see having an independent private sector in which small business and entrepreneurs can work, and then you have a public sector that provides the fundamental necessities that the people need. I see that as being a perfect example to go for as far as the United States. But one aspect I would like to chime in as far as social relations is I see participatory democracy introduced into the political institutions of this country as extremely important, and that the people have a voice beyond simply electing and voting.
Yeah,
and that they have much more stake in the democratic process and much more participation in it.
Yeah.
Than in capitalist society. That is, that socialism would allow bottom up means of communication and alternating means of communication as well. And I see the internet as being the ability, as giving the American people the ability to have that that voice and that way of having democratic means within, not only with on a national scale, but even in their local communities.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important.
Freedom equals the participation in power. That was a quote by FDR. And, I don't think there's anybody that can say that under our current system, the way it is now, that we have any participation in power. There's so many different examples. I agree with you. I would like to see many of these institutions nationalized. The Federal Reserve would be great to be nationalized. The oil companies, because right now, even though, you know, we're such a country that's hell bent on taxes. Well, we want to keep taxes low and taxes low. We hate taxes in America. But if you look at what we're paying, when you include all the externalities, when you include all the tax giveaways, when you include the subsidies and taxpayer cleanups of oil spills, we're paying $13, $14 every gallon of gas that we pump into our cars. And, you know, this goes back to the Zeitgeist movement where we have many resources on this planet, and this is one of the contradictions of capitalism, where sustainability and efficiency are enemies of capitalism. We have many resources that can power the entire Earth and that can be developed quite easily, but we don't because of the for-profit motive that rewards oil companies and other messy forms of energy out there. And it's just one more contradiction that we have to unfortunately suffer through. I agree. We should nationalize many of our private institutions and make them just available for public use, because that becomes a threat. You know, once you start to nationalize industries, once you start to provide government health care, like, for example, you're talking about the Affordable Health Care Act. The Affordable Health Care Act was modeled after what the Heritage Foundation, a conservative corporate think tank, put together in the 1990s. It was basically a conservative healthcare piece of legislation. The only thing that was remotely progressive about it in the initial stages was the public option, and that would have given people a choice to have a government-run healthcare. And as soon as that came out, the Obama administration met with the insurance company executives, and they nixed that. They pulled that right off the table, because that would have been a challenge to our for-profit healthcare industry. You know, if the government stinks, the government can't do anything right, then, you know, why is it that people don't want to give up their Medicare? And why is it that veterans don't want to give up their VA care, and that our members of Congress receive government-run health care? It's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, these are all battles that we have to fight. Wade, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed this discussion. You hit on so many good points, and I'm going to go back and listen to this. I know that many of the people out there are going to go back and listen to this as well. I hope that you would join us in the future for another interesting discussion, because these are the types of discussions that I like, is that they're very, very open-ended. It's not that, you know, we have to contend with commercials and advertisers. We could just kind of let loose here, and we reward our listeners out there. So I thank you. Is there any place on any of the social networking sites that you could direct us to find out more about your group or what you've got going on?
We have two. I can give a brief list of websites. The first website is Revolutionary Unity's main page, which is www.revunity.org. Then there's the Facebook page for Revolutionary Unity Michigan, which is on Facebook. Then we also have an email at revunitymi@gmail.com. And that's it.
Well, listen, comrade, thank you very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it, and we'll be in touch, and hopefully we can have you sometime on the show sometime down the road.
All right, awesome.
Thank you, Wade.
No problem. Bye.
Okay, that was Wade Jackson, chairman of the Revolutionary Unity Michigan, and I got to tell you, he was making a lot of sense. Made a lot of great points here on Carson's Corner, and this was a great interview. Almost went an hour. You know, time flies when you're having fun. Now we have a big heavy hitter on the line. Jeff Howard is with us here on Carson's Corner. We're going to take a brief time out. Then we're going to go right back to the phones and speak to Jeff Howard, who's got a lot to talk about with regards to the Connecticut gun legislation and some of the activities that he's got going on. The guy's a warrior. You've heard him on the show before. Jeff Howard will be on the program after this brief timeout. You're listening to Carson's Corner on Blog Talk Radio. This is Bob Carson. We've got the chat room open. Also, if you want to friend me on Facebook, you can facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Be right back in 2.5 minutes, folks. here on Carson's Corner in conjunction with blogtalkradio.com. My name is Bob Carson, and with us on the line is our old friend, Mr. Jeff Howard. Jeff, how are you, my friend?
Bob, how's it going, brother? Thanks for having me on.
Hey, man, we got a lot to talk about. Why don't we talk about the gun legislation in your home state, Connecticut? What was the type of activism that went into this? And just kind of, you know, give us a picture of what went on in your state.
Well, after Newtown on December 14th, it was a no-brainer. I am on the Move On New Haven County Council, and we got together with the parents of Newtown, and we just pushed this as hard as we could. We now, here in Connecticut, have the toughest gun legislation in the country, tougher than New York, tougher than Colorado. We have banned over 300 different types of assault weapons. We have banned clips of more than 10 rounds. We have instituted a statewide background check and a registry that the Congress somehow refuses to think is a good idea. We now are honoring those 20 dead children in Newtown. And this touches my heart more than most people, Bob, because
yeah.
Newtown is 15 minutes away from my home here in Connecticut. And that day, the heart of the state of Connecticut was ripped out. And I hope the heart of the United States is ripped out. 6 years old, these kids were about 6 years old.
Yep.
How many more dead children is it going to take for the NRA to wake up?
Well, you know, it was even I mean, this is just so disgusting that the NRA was actually calling some of the families and trying to lobby them to be against any type of a gun control measure, which is just really, you know, the height of insensitivity. Because, you know, as you know, President Obama has really been he's been meeting with the families, and they've been participating in trying to rally Congress to just pass these. They're not even gun control measures, as I hate to say it, even Pat Toomey says they're just merely, you know, background checks. I mean. And the families, President Obama has been really criticized by the right wing for, quote, exploiting the families. But in actuality, I would think that many of these families contacted him. Many of these families, after this happened, realized that, you know, this is what has to happen. You have to have people like Adam Lanza. You have to make it very difficult for him to be in an environment where he could pick up his guns from his nutjob mother, who was a prepper. And go and shoot a school. And these victims, the victims' families, you know, you had Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma say that they're being duped by the administration. In other words, these people are just too stupid to have an opinion on gun control, and they can't think for themselves. They're just being manipulated by President Obama. It's really just disgusting, the treatment that these people and President Obama has received over this issue. And again, we're talking about real, not even what your state did, just real tepid measures when it comes to gun control.
And what these right-wing gun nuts don't seem to understand, Bob, is even with Connecticut's assault weapons ban, there are still over 2,000 types of guns that they can still own. Nobody wants to take their deer rifles. Nobody
right.
wants to take their shotguns for hunting ducks or wild turkey or pheasant or quail or anything like that. Hell, we don't even take away their handguns, which I really don't think they personally need. But, you know, even that bastion of liberal thought in the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, said this in the Heller case. That, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't give you the right to own a tank. It doesn't give you the right to own a flamethrower. It doesn't give you right to own an atomic bomb. The the Second Amendment is not all-encompassing. Besides, the Second Amendment doesn't say that, and the right doesn't exist. I'll quote it to your listeners verbatim. It says, and I quote, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the defense of a free people, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Now, what that means is because the Founding Fathers were so terrified of standing armies, they thought militias were enough. But they weren't, and they realized that. Now,
well,
these assault weapons are military assault. Bob, I carried these weapons when I was in the Marine Corps.
Right.
I used them in combat. I know what they can do.
They're weapons of war, and you know, having them on our streets is unnecessary. And I just want to, you know, there was this right wing nut job, this name calling guy named Mark Levin on WABC. And he had another nut job on Ted Cruz, who's this Tea Party guy who you know, nobody, I mean, only the far right of the Republican Party likes this guy. He's being criticized. He's real just really McCarthyite, kind of just unstable Tea Party person, the type of person that is just very, very polarizing and is probably not going to last long. In the Senate, he was on Mark Levin's show, and they're talking about a federal registry. They're talking about this thing. The federal registry doesn't exist. It doesn't. It's a right wing myth. It was literally created out of thin air to conjure up fear and paranoia on a part of these right wing militia type groups. The people that listen to Mark Levin, the people that go to the Tea Party rallies, in some cases, the people that partner up with white supremacist groups out there. It's not in the legislation. At a gun show or at a gun shop, there is a list of individuals that buy guns that is kept on record. But the federal government has no database. But it still doesn't stop these people from propagating this right wing myth to get fear, get people fearful, and get them paranoid. And it's the same thing that the NRA does. And has been doing for years.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. They did the same thing during the health care debate.
Exactly.
How many times did you hear death panels?
Right.
I'd like to know where that is in the legislation, because I read it word for word, and I couldn't find it anyplace.
Right.
I think the National Registry of Gun Owners, personally, in my personal opinion, is a good idea, but it's not part of the legislation. It never
right.
was nationally. We have it here in Connecticut, thank God. And I'll tell you, MoveOn.org, work together with the families in Newtown, and we went to Hartford the day the legislation was being voted on, and the parents passed out pictures of their children. Now, this law passed 98 votes in the Senate and an overwhelming majority in our legislature. Republicans as well as Democrats voted for this law. And I don't see why they can't get it in the Senate. You know, John Adams once said something that hits home to me sometimes, Bob. He said, "One useless man is called a disgrace. Two useless men are a law firm. And three or more become a Congress."
Yeah.
And when you have guys like Inhofe and Cruz and Rand Paul, RuPaul, I like to call him. I know his name is Rand, but it's a lot more funny that way. When you have these people who just live in the pockets of the NRA and the gun manufacturers, we're never going to get anything done.
Well, you know what it is, too, is that you had MSNBC's Martin Bashir, who I like, said something to the effect that Republicans, representatives would have to get their family members murdered in order for them to get to act. And you know, unfortunately, you know, unless something strikes home with many of these Republicans, you know, you look at the issue of gay marriage, where you have almost, you know, unified opposition to gay marriage, but yet people like Rob Portman or people like Dick Cheney, who have gay relatives, they suddenly become out in favor of legislation. Unfortunately, you know, these Republicans now are in more conservative districts. With the gerrymandering, so they don't have to worry about a challenge, except for their party, from the far right wing of their party, and they're basically, you know, adhere to the far right wing forces of their party, and they can't do the right thing. You know, they can't say something as simple as a background check to buy a firearm. You know, for crying out loud, you have to have a background check to get a fishing license. Yeah, yes. You have to go through a background check to get a credit card. You're going to tell me that it's unconstitutional, it's somehow a threat on your liberty to have to go through a background check to buy a firearm? It's ridiculous.
Absolutely ridiculous. Bob, I couldn't agree with you more.
And that's why 90%...
I'd like to know where they read this in the Constitution. I really would.
And that's why 90%, even a Fox News poll, for crying out loud, you know, almost 90% of the population supports these measures, which, again, are very tepid measures to begin with. We're not talking about a ban on assault weapons, which we should be talking about, which was, you know, in this country, in effect in this country from 1994 to 2004. We're talking about these very, very tepid measures. But, you know, when you're dealing with crazy people, you know, crazy Tea Party people out there who unfortunately listen to right-wing talk radio and buy these conspiracy theories, nothing can get done. I'm just glad that at least now they're starting to become marginalized. I hope as we go further, they'll be even further marginalized. But the representatives are safe because political districts have been redrawn to favor them. So now, you know, you have to deal with people like Ted Cruz and so on.
Well, we have a lot more people who are registering as independents, and they are coming more and more to our side. You know, the problem with the Republican Party today is the Tea Party. These people could not be doing more harm to this nation if they were paid agents for a foreign government.
Sure.
In their view, Abraham Lincoln wouldn't be qualified to be president. Theodore Roosevelt wouldn't get the nomination from them. Eisenhower wouldn't get the nomination from them. Bob Dole, who I generally disagreed with, but at least he was a moderate you could talk to, would never get the nomination. They have pushed the moderates and the people who know the word and mean compromise out of the Republican Party. We cannot deal with these people, so we just have to educate, and that's what the Move On here. And unfortunately, I live in the bluest blue state in the entire country, so I'm preaching to the choir, but we have a progressive Democratic governor. Both houses of our legislature are controlled by Democrats. Our entire congressional delegation is Democrat, and both our senators are Democrats. So there's not... But you know, Bob, even here in Connecticut, I cannot tell you how many times I've heard people say, now that we got the N-word president.
I know.
And it's just, I just don't get it. I don't. I'm at the end of my wits here. You know, can I speak to your audience at large right now?
Yes.
Okay, folks, I can't do this anymore, not without your help. We have to organize, protest, raise your voices, occupy something. Democracy starts when you get involved. So everybody out there, tag, you're it.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I do, Jeff. And you know, they say progress is slow, and it can't come fast enough. Well, I certainly agree with that. I kind of want to pivot along here and talk about the federal budget, because this has really been a hot topic of discussion. If I'm not mistaken, in your state of Connecticut, Governor Malloy at one point raised taxes on the very wealthy and actually cut the deficit down. I'm not sure if you guys have a balanced budget, but I believe at some point he did that. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, well, he did a lot. He did raise taxes a little bit, 1-2% on the wealthy. Well, I thought he should have done a lot more, but he said, I'm not going to punish achievement. But what he did do was he cut his own staff by 25%. He cut his own salary. He went to all the state unions and said, look, it's belt-tightening time for everybody, folks. So, and unions were willing to meet him halfway. Not like in Wisconsin or Ohio or Michigan or anywhere else like that. When the governors, when Walker and Kasich and I forget what Michigan's governor, Snyder, didn't take yes for an answer. They just, you know, they just passed anti-union legislation, which is what the Koch brothers want them to do, and the Koch brothers are major contributors to all three of their campaigns.
Yeah, it's the same thing here in New Jersey, where Governor Christie essentially has done zero compromising. It's been his way or no way. And still, we have a 10% unemployment rate, and nothing has changed. There's no jobs in the state. And Governor Christie has been a disaster on just about all fronts. But still, he's still loved by the state media, and so a majority of New Jerseyans think he's doing a good job, unfortunately. But
Sandy's response, I think.
That has a lot to do with it, for sure. I want to talk about President Obama. It's President Obama's budget.
God bless him.
You know, I got to tell you, and I hate to say this, and you know me, Jeff. I've been very critical of President Obama. I don't like the idea of a chain CPI. I don't like the idea of cutting entitlements any iota, because entitlements, by and large, do not deficit. Entitlements did not cause the collapse of 2008, and entitlements stimulate our economy. I don't even like calling them entitlements, but that's what they're generally referred to as. And the idea that we have to cut them is just unbelievable. But the reality is that President Obama does not control the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives is controlled by the Republicans, and if he wants them to vote for something, if he wants to actually get a budget passed, which can fulfill some of the goals that he's had as far as infrastructure spending, job creation, fixing the tax code to make sure that companies don't write off taxes by shipping jobs overseas, and make sure that corporations don't receive unnecessary loopholes and private jet owners don't get taxpayer subsidies, which is ridiculous. If he's going to do all that, then he's going to have to compromise at some point. And the budget that he laid out is basically a center budget, and it's something that he has to do. And at this point, if the Republicans say, okay, you know what, we're going to take you up on the chain CPI, we're going to take you up on some of the other spending cuts, the cuts to Medicare on the provider side or whatever, but we're not going to give up any of these loopholes. We're not going to raise taxes on people. Like, we're not going to institute the Buffett rule. Then you know what? They're going to have a hard time. They're going to lose politically on that front. There's no question about that.
Oh, absolutely. I look. It's Senator Elizabeth Warren said something not too long ago, when she said that 90% of the people on Social Security right now, this is their only source of income. 75% of them, it's only a minor second part of their income. These people spend this money on rent, on food, on electricity, on everything else. They don't salt it away in the Cayman Islands. They live on this money. So, you know, I agree with you 100%, Bob. If I'm the president, I'm standing my ground. The big three, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, are off the table. Now, let's talk about what we can do. We can cut defense spending. We can cut agricultural subsidies to the big companies like Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland. We can, get rid of tobacco and ethanol subsidies. We can, take that $10 billion they voted not too long ago to study boll weevil reproduction. There's a lot of places that we can cut this budget, Bob. But unfortunately, it's only pork when it's in somebody else's state. And and as far as taxes go, we should go back to what it was under Reagan. First 4 years under Reagan, 50% for the top 50, of the top 1% after their deductions.
You know,
we could raise $385 billion. We take half of that, we could create 30 million jobs by doing what this country desperately needs to do, repairing, expanding, and rebuilding our interstate highway system, our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our crumbling schools and universities, harbors and airports, you know, rebuilding the power grid, which desperately needs to be done, putting high-speed Internet and Wi-Fi into every single community in this country. And each one of those 30 million jobs, Bob, would be paying taxes. They'd be spending their money in their local community, stimulating the economy, which leads to more jobs, which leads to more revenue and more growth, and on and on and on. This is economics 101.
Exactly. And you know, I laugh when I hear the Republicans say, oh, we already raised taxes back in January, and therefore that issue is off the table. What that says to me is, as someone who studies this, is obviously the gap between spending and revenue, that's what our deficit is, okay?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're 100% right. Besides, the Bush tax cuts were going to expire anyway. They didn't raise a damn cent.
Exactly. For politically speaking, that's absolutely correct. But what David insisted is, we've already raised taxes. But here's the thing, is that President Obama, if he sticks to this idea of a balanced approach, saying that the gap between spending and revenue is the deficit, you cannot reduce the deficit simply by cutting programs, you cannot incur growth simply by cutting programs. Therefore, the Republican Party, you want to give them credit, maybe they were offered a balanced approach in January, they have to continue that each time we come to the table. You can't balance a budget by just cutting programs. You have to have revenue in those programs or in that budget that tackles some of these unnecessary loopholes and some of the corporate giveaways that we have right now. And here's something that's very interesting. Bernie Sanders pointed this out. In 2012, our tax revenues were 15% of our GDP. When Bill Clinton raised taxes in the 1990s by very modest levels, you know, considering the history of taxation in this country, the tax revenues to a percentage of our GDP was over 20%, and Bill Clinton created 20 million jobs during that period, and so. We have to get back to this idea of, listen, you can't cut it, you can't definitely tax it. And on top of that, record profits from going to corporations, we've got one out of four corporations paying no taxes. We've got $20 sitting in offshore or tax havens. And we've got like Mitt Romney still paying less than his second.
Did I lose you?
No, we're
okay.
Here.
Okay. You're absolutely right, Bob. Let's give everybody out there a little history lesson. In 1952, when Dwight Eisenhower took office, our national debt was 126% of GDP, the highest it's ever been in American history, the highest, higher than it is right now. What did he do? He raised taxes. He borrowed money. He built an interstate highway system. He built the St. Lawrence Seaway. He built his way out of that deficit, and we had the largest expansion, economic expansion in American history, with the top tax rate of 90%. So this crap they keep telling you, we can't raise taxes on the job creators. Well, I got news for you guys. You cut taxes five times on the job creators. Where are the fucking jobs? I'm sorry.
You're good.
Where are the jobs?
Yeah. They're in China. They're overseas.
Yeah, they're in China. They're in Indonesia. They're in India.
Exactly. When you cut taxes on the very wealthy, all you do is add to their bottom line. And, you know, we wonder why corporations are experiencing record profits year after year when demand in the economy is down. We wonder why corporations, you know, and CEO pay is through the roof now while the average worker is living paycheck to paycheck. We wonder why there's been a decoupling of production and wage increases. Well, it's precisely because these corporations are paying no taxes. When corporations pay no taxes, that essentially inflates the price of their stocks. And so, you know, and what happens is – you know, we saw this in 2004. Remember when George W. Bush did that tax holiday where he brought back corporate profits overseas and he taxed it at 5%? Well, you know what these corporations did? They laid off their workers because these corporations count on not paying taxes. They literally figure it into their profit margin, okay? And if they start paying taxes, they're going to start laying off workers for reasons of pure greed. That's it. And what we have to understand here in America is that when corporate America pays no taxes, we have to fit the bill. You and I pay more. These corporations, they're using our resources, they're siphoning our infrastructure, they're laying off our workers, and they're not paying taxes to begin with. It's destroying us, it really is. But if you listen to the Republican Party, and by the way, the chain CPI and the other reforms to entitlements, they were initially proposed by John Boehner in 2011 during his debt ceiling deal with President Obama that never came to fruition. They're not President Obama's ideas, although President Obama is supporting them. They want you to believe that that's how we have to reduce the deficit, on the backs of seniors and individuals that are receiving the benefits from programs that they've paid into their entire lives. It doesn't make any sense, but you know what? I got to tell you, we've moved to the left in this country on social issues like gay marriage and immigration. There's no question about that. But on core issues like the economic issues that rule our lives, we're back to where we started. We're even further to the right. And I hate to use this left-right paradigm, but we're very, very conservative when it comes to these issues.
Well, unfortunately, Bob, I'm older than you are, and I've come to realize over the years that people's convictions very seldom stray far away from their pocketbooks.
Right.
You say raise taxes. Everybody thinks, well, they're coming after my taxes. You can tell them only if you make $400,000 a year, which is 98% of the American people don't make anywhere near that. And the word taxes, you know, I've had this discussion with right-wingers before, especially in my VFW post. And I tell them, you know, you want the government to do all these things. You want the National Institute of Health. You want the VA. There's now a one-year backlog on VA benefits for these guys coming over from Iraq and Afghanistan. That is a national disgrace.
Yep.
It's just something we have to deal with right away. But they want the government to do all these things, and then they don't want to pay for it.
Well,
I just don't understand it. It should be the height of conservatism to say one must pay one's bills.
Yeah, and it's what the Republicans take advantage of, this anti-government rhetoric that in the abstract it seems right, right? I mean, if you're just an average person, a low-information voter, and you hear things like the government stinks, the government can't do anything, the government's too bloated, well, you know, okay, you start to become like the Joe Republican who got a loan from the Small Business Administration, started his business, Joe Republican who got a loan from the GI Bill, went to college, Joe Republican whose mother is on Social Security, and Joe Republican who rides the public roads and rides public transportation, and yet he votes for Ronald Reagan to get the government off of his back. You know, I mean, that's what we're up against. Unfortunately, it's low information people out there that, you know, believe that the government is this, the government is that, but they depend on the government every step of the way. And what I like to do on this program is make people aware just how much they depend on the United States government. Everybody depends on the United States government. Everybody does. Everybody that lives in this country depends on the United States government. And the government and regulations create jobs in this country. You know, they do. People like to overlook this. People take things for granted. But government regulation, government involvement in the community, in the state, at the federal level, that creates jobs. And, you know, we have to spell that out, just how important it is. Now, we have a choice. We can allow government to work for us. We could essentially have the government for we, the people, or we can have government for the transnational corporations, which has been the law of the land for the past 30 years. I'd rather have the former. I'd rather have government for we, the people, so that we have a chance to actually live the American dream, which at one point existed in this country. It doesn't anymore, but at one point it did. We have to reclaim the dream, and that's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take another political revolution, I think.
Absolutely, Bob, and I'd like to urge all of your listeners out there who agree with you, go to a website. It's called RebuildTheDream.com. It's an organization that was started by Van Jones, who is a good man. I know Van. I've met him, and he is a good man, and he wants to rebuild the American dream. Now, Bob, the Republicans keep telling us three things. One, they keep telling us we're broke, we're broke, we're broke.
Right.
Well, guess what? We're not broke.
We're not broke.
Our GDP is higher than China's, by far higher than China's. We just spend money on the wrong things. If we invested in our rebuilding our infrastructure, if we invested in our schools and our people, we could grow out of this deficit we are in, which the Republicans and their corporate masters caused. Two, they keep telling us that the government is the problem. Well, the government is not the problem. Not always. The government can be the solution. In every single economic crisis we have ever had, the government has stepped in and had these major, major public works projects. In the 1840s, they built the Erie Canal and all the other canal systems, which put thousands of people to work. In the 1930s, we had the New Deal, where and the NRA, which put thousands of people to work. You should be doing in the 1960s. No, Bob, there was a time in this country that we built great things. We built the Hoover Dam. We built the Brooklyn Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge. We had incredible technological achievements. We reached for the stars. We fought wars on poverty, not on poor people.
Right.
That's why, I love my country with all of my heart. I would gladly lay down my life for it. I spent 27 years in the military service of my country, and I would do so again, even though I'm pushing 60. The point is that we are 29th in math scores in this country. We're 27th in science, 148th in infant mortality.
Yep.
And, we're not the greatest country on the world anymore. We could be if we stand up for what this country has always stood for, our people. It's written into the first line of the Constitution, Bob. We, the people. Not the multinational corporations. Well, they have their place, too. I have no problem with them making a buck.
Right.
It's about time they start paying their fair share.
Well,
you talked about...
We are not a great country anymore, and you talk about how, we've lost our value system. And I would submit to you that this has a lot to do with what happened to Great Britain in 1979 with the election of Margaret Thatcher, who passed away last week. And some of the things that she did while Prime Minister of that country, unfortunately, seeped its way over to here, with the election of Ronald Reagan, and all of a sudden, the role of the government, this transformational role, this new role of the government, was to no longer be a backstop for the poor, middle class, and so on and so forth. Was to no longer invest in our country. It was to basically turn a profit. We're going to put more business into government and less government into business, sort of what was done during the 1920s, during the so-called Roaring Twenties, with Calvin Coolidge and Silent Cal and so on and so forth. And this distorted value system that we have that values profit over things like human life. We track profit. We have the sequence of money is tracked, and we measure success by artificial measurements like the GDP and the stock market and the unemployment rate and the rate of inflation. But we don't measure things by how people are actually doing, like, you know, how things you're talking about, infant mortality, life expectancy, wealth accumulation, the rate of disease, the rate of poverty, and whatnot. And our whole value system, starting with Ronald Reagan, has been turned upside down. There's just really no debate about this. And it's been 30-plus years of these economic policies that have turned us almost into a third-world nation. What I see is, I got to tell you, I don't see there are people out there that are aware. I mean, you had the Occupy movements. You have people like Wade Jackson in my first hour. You got people like you and me and others that are aware. But still, we seem to be going on the same path that we're going towards, which is more corporate control, more economic power ruling over us, less workers' rights, or as Wade Jackson or as Karl Marx would say, workers' privileges, more domination and more, you know, austerity for the rest of us. So I just there has to be a breaking point at some point.
Oh, absolutely. But let me say, I was listening to a little of your show with Mr. Jackson, and I he had some good points, but I also disagree with him on several things. You know, capitalism doesn't need to be destroyed. It needs to be fixed. I mean, you know, I got no problem with anybody making a profit. That's
right.
What you're in business for. But you have to understand, like Elizabeth Warren said, our social contract says you pay some of that forward for the next generation. You know, capitalism needs to be fixed, not destroyed.
Right.
So I do disagree with a little bit of what Mr. Jackson said, but it comes down to one thing, you know, as far as I'm concerned. When Ronald Reagan took office, unemployment was 7.9%, all right? By the midterm election, it was 10.5%. Then, after raising taxes 11 times on the poor and the middle class, destroying American industries, starting offshoring where they shipped millions of jobs overseas. And by the time he left office, unemployment was 7.9%, exactly where it was when he took office. You know, he had tripled the national debt.
Yep.
And I'd just like to know why Ronald Reagan was such a great president.
Because the right wing and the corporate media, corporate vested interests who benefit financially from perpetuating his economic policies have launched a major campaign to immortalize Ronald Reagan, the same thing that they did for Margaret Thatcher. I mean, look at what they've done to their respective countries. I mean, you know, they've been a complete disaster for each country, and yet you could pay someone anything to say anything. There was a time in America where you had the tobacco lobbyists that were paying news reporters and paying reporters to write favorably about tobacco. You know, Ronald Reagan famously recorded a commercial for, I believe it was Benson Hedges, talking about the benefits of smoking cigarettes. And, you know, you could, again, if you pay someone enough money, like these right-wing shills that you see on Fox News and listen to on talk radio, they will tell their audience whatever their paymaster tells them to say. And
absolutely.
Ronald Reagan, who was just results speaking, was a bad president. You mentioned triple the national debt. Unemployment rose. Reagan left office in a recession. The unemployment rate was essentially the same as it was when he came into the office. The airline industry has never recovered from Reagan's busting up of PATCO. Unions have never recovered from Reagan, and we have a whole host of different problems. You know, trade barriers were eliminated. He stopped enforcing antitrust laws, and all of this has culminated into a society now that is just deteriorating, and we haven't been able to reverse course. And so that's why, it's because Reagan's policies continue to benefit the financial elite, and until you know, we gain enough power to reverse his policies, nothing is going to change. Now, I agree with you. I don't think that we need to abolish capitalism. I don't think that we can go to a stateless and classless society. It's really never been done before, as far as I could tell. You need some sort of regulation. You need some sort of power structure, because if another power structure will move into place. If we got, you know, if we got rid of the United States government, we got rid of all regulation, something else would turn out to rule, and that's just the way it is. We're a civilized society, and we have laws, and we have power structures, and we have to obey them. Nothing's going to be perfect, but our present form of capitalism, as John Perkins said, he's the author of The Confessions of an Economic Hitman and Hoodwinked, our present form of capitalism is not working.
No, absolutely. He's absolutely right. Like I said before, it needs to be fixed. See, I want to live in a nation where the wealth that is generated by that nation goes to aid all of its people, not
yep.
just to the enrichment of a few.
Yep.
And it just comes down to that. As long as the people of this nation are so ill-informed that they think that Fox News and the rest of them are telling them the truth because they love them and they care for them, when, you know, you can, all you have to do is look some facts up, and you can see that Fox News lies to them constantly.
Right.
There's not a word of truth that comes out of Sean Insanity or Bill O'Jackass.
That's right.
Don't get me started on Fat Ass Limbaugh.
Oh, yeah. I know. And I think that part of the reason why people listen to them is they hear their prejudices reinforced. I was at the supermarket today, right, and a lady was ringing me up. And so, you know, she's I don't know what country she's from, but she's sitting there railing against welfare recipients, telling me how welfare recipients are just living large and you know, the typical Ronald Reagan welfare queen myth, where we have to look at welfare recipients as if they're somehow draining our taxpayer dollars. Don't look at the corporations. Don't look at the rich person. Now, look at these poor welfare recipients who are at most are receiving $200 a month and practically have to sell their children to get that. You know, don't look at them. It's just it's sort of this self-cannibalizing process here. That you had one baron years ago said I could pay half of the middle class to devour the other half of the middle class, and that notion created, you know, Fox News, it created right wing talk radio, and it's all funded by these groups that stand to benefit from the way things are. We have to ask ourselves: are we benefiting from the way things are? Are we moving forward, or are we basically, you know, trying to avoid drowning? And I think the vast majority of us would say, no, we're not benefiting under our current economic systems. There's no hope for us because of the way the system is. And therefore, if we're not benefiting, somebody is benefiting. You know, you've got Tom Hartman did a great study about this or did a great segment on a show about this a couple of years ago or a couple of weeks ago on how before Ronald Reagan, most of the country's wealth was in most of the country's hands. But after Ronald Reagan, something like, you know, 90% of the wealth has been controlled by just a small group of people. And that is very unhealthy for democracy. When you have such a small group of people controlling so much of the nation's wealth, first of all, that's not the result of the free market, because the free market doesn't exist. The market is a creation of the United States government, and one team or one person or one group of people winning every time, you know, suggests that the game is rigged. Second of all, it is extremely toxic to our country. You know, if you have no wealth, you have nothing to your name, then you're not going to be able to survive an illness, or you're not going to be able to survive a layoff, or so on and so forth. And this is a cycle of just deterioration. It really is. It's unfortunately a race to the bottom. We here in America, you're five times more likely to go into poverty than you are to become rich, and that has to change.
Oh, absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I've heard Tom Hartman say it. He wants it on his, he told his wife, he wants it on his tombstone. This all started with Reagan.
Yep.
And Reagan, you know, I'm sure he was a good man. I'm sure he did what he thought was right, or at least what his financial backers told him was right. But when he was governor of California, he came into office when California was a state of a dramatic problems. Unemployment was going through the roof. The entire system was collapsing. First thing he did was raise taxes.
Yep.
First thing he did was strengthen union laws and sign into legislation union strengthening laws. He signed into law the most liberal pro-abortion bill in American history when he was governor of California. So this thing that he was a conservative warrior, he was not a conservative warrior. He was a political chameleon. He said whatever he had to say, did whatever he had to do to get elected.
Well, and even as president, he did raise taxes 11 times.
On the poor and the middle class.
Yeah, exactly. He also jailed many of the banksters that were involved with the SNL scandal.
Wasn't that under Bush?
No, that was under Reagan. He appointed Bill Seidman, and I think that was 1987. And he jailed hundreds of bankers. And Reagan, you know, at one point even railed against the loopholes that people like Mitt Romney enjoy, to where a bus driver, he said, it's crazy that a bus driver can pay more of his income to the government for taxes than a millionaire. And so, I mean, he wasn't by today's standards. Reagan would be a primary challenge. He would be considered a moderate Republican, which is really unfortunate, and it shows you just how far we've gone. But he really kicked off. He really kicked the door off the hinges on many of the areas that we talked about: taxation, the role of government, unions, We started really deregulating under Carter a lot. I mean, Carter signed a lot of bills that deregulated certain industries, but Reagan, modeling himself after Thatcher, really kicked it into overdrive there. And we're still recovering, but in order to fix it, we have to know what's wrong. And what's wrong is not the fact that we have a government. It's not as Rand Paul and Ron Paul say it is, okay? What's wrong is the government has been taken over by special interests, and the only thing that's going to stop these special interests from just totally robbing our treasury is we the people. We have to understand that we basically have the same interests. You know, we want to be paid for the work that we produce. We want our children to go to a good school and get a good education, and we want our retirements to be safe. And in order to achieve these goals, we have to embrace what has worked in this country, you know, from the Wagner Act on. We have to embrace good government, good government.
Absolutely. But as far as education goes, you know, where Sarah Palin said the other day that she's against public education, every Republican governor is cutting education left and right to give tax breaks to the wealthy. Well, they don't want an educated population. They want mindless drones who will work, consume, and reproduce more mindless drones to work, consume, and reproduce. They don't want to teach these kids to think. They teach these kids to think, they might start asking questions. They might start, we can't have that, can we?
Well, you know what's really, really bothersome is you look at our education system, and you want to talk about the libertarian right-wing propaganda that is infiltrating our education system. Look at someone like John Stossel, this guy on Fox News, who some right-wing think tank spent, you know, one of these right-wing institutions spent $400 million making sure that John Stossel and his, you know, libertarian ideas get to indoctrinate our children at school. You look at the Koch brothers and their massive funding efforts to basically put Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged into college curriculums all across America. You look at the privatization of our school systems led by the DeVos family of Michigan, which stands to make a fortune. You've got billionaires like David Tepper here in New Jersey working with Governor Christie and other corporate interests to privatize our education system and basically turn it over to Wall Street. And that's what I'm worried about. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, if we had handed
Social Security over to Wall Street the way that Ronald Reagan tried to do in the 80s, what would have happened when the stock market collapsed in 2007?
Yeah.
Not even sure Barry Goldwater wouldn't be primaried by this Republican Party.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was anybody more conservative than Barry Goldwater.
And that's why I'm worried that we're going towards fascism here. I really do. I mean, we're already there in certain areas. You've already got almost like a complete merger of the corporate state and the state itself. I mean, you can look at groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and look at the Chamber of Commerce and see just how intertwined business and government is. And then you look at the people in the Republican Party that are essentially taking their marching orders from big business, and that's scary. And what's even more scary is that people will support that. You know, Dick Cheney, in the rest of the world, Dick Cheney was looked at as a dictator, okay? The guy, he really, many people feel he should be in jail for war crimes. But here in the United States of America, only a certain percentage of people view him as a dictator. And you've got people, white people that watch Fox News that support Dick Cheney. To me, I find it impossible, the notion that anybody could support Dick Cheney. But there are people out there that do, which shows you the power of the corporate state. To get somebody to support someone like Dick Cheney and what he's done shows you the power of fascist propaganda that exists out there.
Well, Bob, unfortunately, there's still a certain population of this country who thinks that the Iraq War wasn't started on a bunch of lies.
Yeah.
There's still a certain population in this country that doesn't realize that Dick Cheney, when he was vice president, never sold his Halliburton stock, and he was the one who issued all these contracts, ushered and maneuvered all these contracts to Halliburton during the Iraq and Afghan wars.
And how the hell did they get away
with
that?
Billions.
Exactly. I mean, look, I President Obama, I mean, could you imagine if President Obama started a war under false pretenses, was linked to a company, had stock in a company that profited tremendously from this war, lied about the war, committed all these atrocities. Could you imagine if President Obama did that? It's just mind-boggling what these people can get away with. Dick Cheney, with the Bush administration, with Enron, with the outing of CIA agents, the firing of federal judges. I mean,
well, how fast would the impeachment proceedings start if Obama did this? But I have said this all along. During the Bush administration, homes entered and phones tapped without warrant, people held indefinitely without criminal charge, and in some cases the right to freedom of assembly itself denied.
Yep.
These are the acts of a tyrant, Bob.
Yep.
George Bush will be a tyrant whether I call him one or not. I might as well call him one. And if the FBI wants to arrest me for that, bring it on, brother.
I agree. You got Maggie Thatcher, who previously she previously supported Augusto Pinochet, who was a right-wing dictator who killed thousands of people.
Meanwhile, she called Nelson Mandela a bloody terrorist.
That's right. And what the hell? And people support that. And that really, it sends chills up my spine that people can support this. And it shows you the power of propaganda that you know, we could support anything. You know, we really can. And don't be surprised if we become completely under the rule of a dictator. It could happen in America.
Well, I'll tell you something, Bob. Not as long as I have the ability to draw breath or hold a freedom fighter's rifle. I defended my country for 27 years, and I will gladly do it again if it ever comes to this. I love my country. I love my country with all my heart, and I want to see it better. That's why I protest. That's why I raise my voice. That's why I was at all the Occupy events I could get to. You know, I was a member of an organization called Occupy Marines, and here in New Haven, when the New Haven Police Department tried to throw the people off the New Haven Green, about 40 of us stood between the protesters and the police. And I looked at the police lieutenant in charge. I said, "Lieutenant, we are going to stand our ground, and we will not respond unless fired upon. But if you want another civil war, let it start here."
I think
and
I remember
that's how
that.
I feel.
Well, listen, Jeff, it's a pleasure having you on our side. Your passion, your intensity is just something to be admired. It really is.
Well, I just want to say, Bob, thank you. Thank you for all of you do. All you do. We have got to get the truth out there. That's why guys like Tom Hartman and Stephanie Miller and Rachel Maddow and Ed Schultz and the few liberal voices who are still out there, thank you for all of you do. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you, Jeff, my friend. Take care, and we'll speak to you sometime down the road.
Right. I love you, brother.
Love you too, man. Take care.
Bye.
All right. That was Jeff Howard. You could friend him on my Facebook page. Also, friend me, facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. And you could like the Carson's Corner page at facebook.com/CarsonsCorner13. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.